Hey guys, this is Diego Moyano, and you're listening to the Players and Player Podcast.
Welcome to the Payers and Players Podcast, a podcast dedicated to bringing you the most interesting names in the game and diving into the issues around the junior tennis development journey. If you are not already following us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, our handle is Payers Players. And if you'd like to contact us, we'd love to hear your feedback. Our email address is payersandplayers@gmail.com. Finally, if you haven't already done so, we'd really appreciate a 5-star rating on iTunes. And if you find value in our podcast, you can donate on our website, which is www.payersandplayers.com, where you can also find all of our show notes as well as other amazing content.
Today, we're so excited to speak with Diego Moyano. Diego's a former professional tennis player from Argentina. In the past, he coached players like Tommy Paul and Riley Opelka. He also coached Dennis Kudla. Currently, he has announced that he is going to be coaching Kevin Anderson on the professional tour. The conversation we had with Diego was one of the best ones I can remember. He brought a lot of insight into junior development and gave a ton of great tips for parents who are raising young tennis stars. So with that, let's bring on Diego. We hope you enjoy.
Hey, Diego, this is Scott. Welcome to the show. We're so excited to talk to you.
Hi, guys. Hi, Scott, Robert. Thanks for having me on the show.
Hey, before we get into some of the issues, I want to get a little bit of your background. I know I've heard a little bit about your tennis journey as a junior in Argentina to becoming a professional, and I think it's really unique and it's a good story. So maybe we can start with that.
Yeah, so I started in Argentina. I made my junior career until I was 14 years old. Then my parents, they got in bankrupt in Argentina in a big economic crisis, and my coach at that time told me that my only way to keep playing tennis was going to Europe, in France, which the country had a very nice money tournament circuit that I could keep playing tennis, improving and paying my bills. So I made the decision of going to France at 14 years old, and that's what I did. I lived 16 years in France, trying to improve and get better. In 97, so I was playing some ATP. That was my dream all the time. Made it on the ATP tour, but I didn't have the level, I didn't have the money, so I had to like grow and kind of improve. In 97, I started playing full time, in the ATP, where now living in France, a couple more years until the age of 29 years old. I went back to Argentina for a couple of years until 31, that I got injured. I had to retire in 2005. And then from there, I didn't know what to do. Because I never thought about stopping and coaching. So I didn't know what to do. So I took a little time to think about what I needed and I wanted to do. And so when I started coaching, I had a first great player to play. I mean, I started working on the team with Guillermo Coria. At that time was number 5 in the world. And from there I realized that I really liked this coaching on the pro circuit, and that's what I did. I started my journey as a coach and get better and try to improve to be the best coach that I can be. So that's a little bit in general my background.
Can you tell us about some of the players that you have coached here in the last couple of years, or some of the good players that you've coached in your career?
Well, so as I mentioned, I started with Guillermo Coria. He was number 5 in the world. In 2006, 2007, and part of 2008, I was working with Paul Capdeville, which he broke top 100 at that time. Carlos Berloc, an Argentinian, and I helped the team with Fernando Gonzalez, which we won together in Viña del Mar ATP. He was top 10 at that time again. Then from there, 2008, I started working with Robbie Ginepri. I worked with him for 2 years almost, until I joined the USTA as a lead national coach in 2010. So I had my academy in Argentina, which I trained also a few top 100 players like Brian Daboul, Diego Harfield, and Martin Basilio Arguello. In 2010, I joined the USTA as a lead national coach, as I say, and I started working with the, so the, my first group, kind of my age, was the 92s. Dennis Kudla was my main player there. Jack Sock, Ryan Harrison. I had two different times with Ryan. One was that year, 2010, when he qualified and beat Ljubicic at the US Open. He was around 17, 18 years old. From there, I took over also. So while I was coaching Dennis Kudla, I spent time with Sam Querrey, Steve Johnson, Bradley Klein, Ryan Williams, Dennis Sandgren. And then I took over the group of 97, developing the group of 97, 98, starting in 2012, while I was coaching still Dennis Kudla. I spent 5 years with him. And so I took over that group as well. That was part of Tommy Paul, Riley Opelka, several guys, William Blomberg that is in UNC, who was Francis, I was overseeing. He was in JTCC, but I had the mission of overseeing him as well, as far as the best player on that group. Same thing with Stefan Kozlov. I had Taylor Fritz, who started with me at 14 years old, like a year and a half later, after I took Tommy and Riley. And I spent almost 7 years with Riley, 8 years with Tommy Paul, 4 years and a half with Francis, because I started working with Francis later on when he was 15, 16. And with Taylor Fritz, same thing, until 18, I stopped. Kind of he transferred to the West Coast after winning the U.S. Open in 2015. So basically, I think except John Isner, I worked with almost every American player until now.
That's an impressive roster of players that you're involved with. Every one of them, I think everyone knows those names. So question is, you know, how did you guys identify that talent and bring them to the USTA? And at what age did they start training at USTA?
So we made a few mistakes. We started, obviously, the idea was identify everybody's situation at a young age. So when we started this process in 2009, 2010, the idea was kind of trying to be more involved on the developing the American players. So we help the private sector to set up standards where we could help to develop the best players that we can develop as a unit, as a country. So that was the idea, helping the private sector. So for that, we start on the talent ID. We put a lot of focus on the talent ID. First was Martin Blackman at that time, and then Ken Kinnear took over that post. The objective was like not missing any player at young age. So we tried to divide the country. It's a big country, a lot of players. So we divide, in at some point we divided the country in 22 sections. We kind of understood that the 22 sections were too much. So we kind of reduced that. We went to 17 and until we found a, we found comfortable kind of detecting every single player that could we could detect. So that, that was one. The second, we realized that we started bringing the kids too early to the USTA to train and kind of leave. So now we address that at some point, and we start like bringing start bringing like per time, not living there, but at 14 years old they start like except the kids. For example, Tommy moved to Boca Raton at some point. Riley moved to Boca Raton, so they were living with their family in Boca Raton. Taylor was coming in and out, but the time that he was staying in Boca was like 2 months or 6 weeks at the time. So we kind of changed that because we realized that too young, at 12, 13 years old, the kids they couldn't live without the parents, on at the USTA. So that's that response to your question. Around 14, 15, they start like spending a lot of time with us, but not living until we realized, I mean, until the family thought that was the right time to let it kind of go and train a little bit more outside the family or outside the home.
Mm-hmm. Hey, so Diego, tell me this as the USTA was identifying talent, how did they identify talent? And if they should have done it different, in your opinion, how would you have done it different so that you would have better identified who the best players were?
No, I think, that was the other part of the question. I think in my time there for 10 years, I think we did a pretty good job. You always have a margin. I think one of the ideas that we had was bring all the kids, the best player together. We spent a lot of time going to the tournament, so going to the section. We had couple like set up. We create some habits, which was national coaches or every camp in the country trying to have at least one national coach. Just to have an idea of the kids and understand the kids that we have. Well, that's one. Go into every single tournament and try to see every single match and watch every game. In my time there, I was going to a tournament, the junior tournament, with a camera. So, and I was like filming every single match that I could. So I had a database of every single player, and then again 2 weeks, I mean 2 weeks later or a month later or 2 months later, I was recording and I could follow the improvement of that player, talking right. with the parents, talking with the private coaches, so following the direction. So that's another thing, and then bringing the kids, the best kids, all the time at the center to earn their own opportunities. So that was a big idea. So I have the kids coming in and playing for Wildcards in the future, playing for Wildcards in Challenger. No, at that time during 10 years we didn't give any or very few, at least with the players that I was working with, very few players they had a Wildcard given on a decision on an office. Everybody was earning. So one a good example was that Ryan Harrison, 2010, he was the best 92 in the country at that time, and he played the Wildcard tournament, Wildcard playoff that held in Boca Raton, and he lost in the final against Tim Smith. So he has to play the qualies. And then he won the qualies, and after that he won. He beat Lubitsch. Things like that all the time.
Yeah.
So I had Riley Opelka and well the 95s as well. Ty Kwiatkowski, Luca Corintelli, same thing. I mean, we had Spencer Papa. All the guys like playing for Wildcats all the time and mixing. So when the 95. They were at the age of playing the Futures. We had the 97, 98 playing with them. Riley Opelka, Tommy Paul. I mean, they were like all mixing up. And same after that. When they, for example, remember a wildcard tournament held, for example, Riley Opelka won it and played Robbie Ginepri in the Future, lost 0-1. But things like that every single time for different situations. So we try to put all the kids in situation to earn their opportunities. So that's how you see the talent, you know. Because when you put 20 players together, you realize that not all 20 they go up. So you have when you put the 20 best college players or I mean more mature they are, maybe the percentage they're going up, but on young ages. When you put like 15 players together, 5 they're gonna go up, 5 they're gonna go down, and in the middle they're gonna stay in the middle, and maybe 1 is gonna go up later on. That's kind of when you put guys in a group competing against each other. That's how you see how the competition goes. You know, I mean the kids they're not all going up.
Yeah. And so when you were looking at those, when you're going to those tournaments and you're, you know, videoing all the matches, were you looking more for results or were you looking more for, you know, game style and were you taking into account, you know, whether or not a kid might be an early developer versus a kid that might be, you know, not reaching his puberty as soon, or were those things that you were taking into consideration?
Yeah, that's a great question. The result was not the first priority. At all, it was like very, very low on the list. Obviously, you need all the things taken care. One is compete well, so the result obviously is important, but it's not the main important at young age. So good movers. I was looking at good body type, good bodies where they are. I mean. They can be, doesn't matter if they're big or small, but they're good movers. They have good balance, good speed, good balance. They can change direction. They have a good support system. That was one. Second, doesn't matter if they were winning or not, weapons. You see if they're explosive, if they have some natural weapons that they feel. So that's another thing that, for example, moving up, I was looking for those players, how they react, the mindset, if they're good workers, if they compete well, even if they were losing, but kids that they really want to improve, they have the big picture. Some kids, even if they're 13, 14, they can see that big picture a little clearer than other kids. So things like that, the understanding of the core, understanding of the tennis, understanding the time. So that was another thing. I mean, players that understand the time are huge. Understand when they take time away, when they give time, when they need time to defend. You know, the different position of the core. That's something that I was looking. And then lately, obviously, as I mentioned before, a little bit the result. But it's nice to be clear. The results are not important at young ages because you don't want the kid to be winning all the time. Because a kid that is 13, 14 is winning a lot is difficult to coach. Because how you convince a kid that has improved when he's winning everything?
So, exactly.
As I always mention, for me, it's good that the kid is winning because that shows that they have confidence and they're good competitors. But they need they need to lose. They need to lose as well, because that's how you can coach later on their career.
Hey, so Diego, do you have an example of a kid that was maybe at 12, 13, way bigger than everybody, and he won because he was way bigger than everybody, but then when he was 18, he wasn't way everybody and he struggled? And then on the other end, do you have an example of a kid that was real little when he was 12, 13, but then he grew and ended up being a much better player at 17, 18 than he was at 12 or 13?
One good example of that is Riley Opelka. Riley Opelka, when he was young, I have pictures. He was my height, so he was not too big. We knew that he's gonna be big. So my whole junior career, so 12, 13, 14, 15, I have him moving, doing two on one, changing direction, playing baseline game without serve. So he was, and many times he was pissed with me because I was making him play without the serve, because my whole vision was he has to learn how to move and play from different position and have, understand his balance and understand how to create power, from young age, because when he's going to grow, then everything is done. Now we're going to focus more on his identity and his big serve and big shot. And that's how he was developed. He was developed that way. So he understands the court pretty well. He has all the shots. He understands the defense, understands the offense. And now, obviously, it's easy for him to use all those tools at the right moment. So that's one of the example of
And let me interrupt you for a second. So I'm looking up online, and it says online that you're 5'9", 5 feet 9 inches. Would you agree with that height on Wikipedia?
I'm 6. I'm 6 feet.
6 feet, okay. Yeah. So you said when Riley Opelka was 12, he was your height. So maybe
he was a little, that was 13 years old. You can look at my Instagram, and you see the picture of him, Tommy Paul and myself together. Tommy was a little like smaller, but Riley and me were like kind of the same height. He was already obviously big, but you know that he's gonna get bigger and bigger. We have players like they were the same height at that time, was like Luca Corintelli, Alexios Alevian, even Ryan Harrison, he was pretty tall at that time as well, like same height like that.
But was there a player, like I'm thinking, who's the guy from Australia, Scott, that's like 20, 21 right now?
The small guy, Demonur.
They say when Demonur was 12, he was like 80 pounds, right?
He was skinny. Yeah, you have some players like that.
So that's what I'm asking you. Was there, because I see some of these players that are huge for 12 years old, but then when they get to 18, they're regular size. And then I see these kids that are like Demonur, who was 80 pounds when he's 12, but he grew into his body. And so that's what I'm asking you. Did you see any kids that were way too big for their age and they won because of it? And then other kids who were real little for their age and they lost, but as they got older, they started winning more. Did you see that?
You see that. I don't have like a clear, because
example.
You see that because there's signs, when you have experience and on that business, you understand, you see the hair on the leg, you see, so you understand. That at some point when they're 14 and you have the hair on the legs and then you know that they're not gonna grow much more and you understand when they make good decisions anyway on the court based on if they're big or small, doesn't matter, when they make good decisions and the way that they want to play. Demoler was always really fast. Same with Diego Schwarman, for example, from Argentina. he is really small, but he was always really fast, really good balance. So you have to pay attention on that. It doesn't matter how big or small, the way that they play, the speed, the balance, the way that they see the tennis. So that's also very very important. Like I said, Tommy wasn't really big when he was young, but he has a very light arm. Actually at 14 we had to change. I had to put like Tommy 13, 14 through a program where he changed the forehand and he changed the serve because the way that he was playing, he had all the shots like locked and couldn't accelerate his wrist. Couldn't use his live arm on the serve. So so what I'm saying is, you see that a lot, but you if you pay attention on those details, you understand that the kids, they're not gonna grow much more, and they're winning because they're too big, or kids that they're not winning, but they're gonna grow into their bodies, and then they're gonna right. are making the decisions, and they're gonna start like progressing quickly.
Right.
Yeah. Hey, so Diego, so were you saying then that Tommy at a younger age was more of a, you know, I don't want to use a derogatory term, but more of a pusher or a moonball type player that you had to develop into a bigger hitter?
Yes. He was a great mover. But he was not. Uh-huh. He was making balls. Great backhand, BMS backhand. But with the forehand, he was a pusher with a Western grip, and he had to he understood how to develop that big forehand and with loose and live arm. So actually, Taylor Fritz under 12, he was a moon baller. I mean, he was playing moon balls all the time. Actually laugh about that because he couldn't win a match because he was just playing and making balls until he started like hitting the ball well, and obviously he has an amazing all his life he has an amazing timing. When I first saw him at the 14, he had unbelievable timing but no movement. So he couldn't move on clay court, for example, he couldn't move and he was struggling to understand how to play certain balls. And then, again, the first month he was like side to side with hand feeding on clay until the first day he landed from California, never played on clay. He practiced with Henry Wirholm. At that time, he was number one or number two in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to change him from to another court because he couldn't make two balls with Henry Wirholm. So the whole month, he was like side to side, hand feeding, understanding how to move on clay, how to defend on clay, how to play the best ball, when to play cross, when to change direction. And the last, I think it was the third playoff that month, he played Henrik on a real match for a wilder, and he beat Henry Wirholm on clay. So, yeah. So that's kind of going into that thing of doesn't matter if they win or not, it's the willingness of improvement that also you have to take in consideration.
All right, so Diego, can you think of a kid that you coached who ended up outperforming his ability? So his talent was not as much, but he worked super hard and ended up maybe having a better career than he should have.
But the first player about that is Dennis Kula.
Yeah.
For sure. 50 in the world. I mean, he is a workhorse. I mean, he works so hard, all the time. I had him, working in the morning, afternoon, fitness in the morning. I mean, he was like doing fitness in the morning, tennis in the morning, tennis in the afternoon, fitness in the afternoon, every day, from 17, 18, same thing. I mean, he was like, I had to explain him because when I started with him, he said, well, I'm not practicing Saturday or Sunday. So I said, well, that's going to change because as a tennis player, we don't have Saturdays or Sundays. It's every day is the same. You never know when you're going to have a day off. you could have a day off on Tuesday, you can have a day off on Wednesday, you can have a day off on Sunday. You never know. So we're going to work, and you're going to have your rest day, but you never know when it's going to be your rest day. So the first one to overachieve is for sure Dennis. And then players that they're really I don't know if the word is overachieved, but I think Steve Johnson very smart on how he went to his career, and understood how to cover the weakness and understood how to get better on their weapons. So I think being 20 in the world, I think is great. I mean, very smart how he went and how he improved and the work that he put on and how he went about his body, nutrition, fitness, everything. So that that could be, I don't know if but it could be another one. The rest I don't know. I have that's what I'm saying. On the list, I think Dennis will be the first one of answering that question.
Okay. Diego, going back to what you're saying, when you said that you were looking, you know, part of your talent identification was to identify weapons, and I'm assuming you're looking at kids that are 11, 12 years old. So I'm wondering, what weapons were you looking for in those kids, and what can juniors at that age do to develop weapons, even if their bodies may not be big enough to, you know, have a monster serve or anything like that? So what should a 11, 12-year-old do to develop those weapons, and what kind of weapons should they be developing?
I mean, it's a great question. I mean, we're not talking 11, 12, 13, 14, obviously. I mean, you have that range. For example, I always encourage the kids, even if they're 12 years old, you see the kids, the willingness to, for example, come forward and come to the net. And you say, well, they don't have a big serve. No, they don't. But you see them try to play the serve and try to use the serve as a weapon. That is the first step. If you have a kid that has that naturally, he has that skill of having the serve, grab the ball, and understand that he has to place the serve somewhere and play. They can play with that serve. That's a huge advantage, because 3 years later, when you're gonna tell the kid, well, you're gonna serve why, and you're gonna come, you're gonna do serve and volley. They already know. They already been there. Even if they didn't win matches, but they already been there. So that's a huge advantage when you have a kid like that. For example, one, you're looking at that. Two, you're looking at if the kid is understanding the time. Is they taking time? So you see, if they cutting the angle, for example, a young age, you have a kid that is 11, 12 years old, they're cutting the angle on the forehand side, right? So they understand time, they are understanding cutting the angles. So when you cut the angle like that and you're taking time away, you're closer to the net and probably you're going to develop a bigger forehand. Power-wise, or time or placement, but your head is already thinking about how to hurt your opponent. So that is a big advantage as well. When the kid doesn't have the power, because everybody's thinking weapon equal power. No?
Right.
You have four different ways to be aggressive, in my opinion. Power, placement, time, right? And positioning. So you have a kid that uses the time, uses the positioning to be aggressive, is a big weapon. On the tennis today, you see the players, how they're moving. So that's another thing. The movement, you see a kid that is unbelievable athlete. So now you have a natural weapon out there. Kids like, for example, a good example was Francis Tiafoe. You see the kid moving. And or Michael Moe, for example, he's everywhere. De Munar, you just mentioned De Munar, great athlete. He couldn't crack an egg, but he was everywhere. So he was great, cool position, understand the time. Now he's moving, not ball passed by him. So now you have something. Félix Auger-Aliassime, for example, growing up, you see he was a little kid, but a very explosive, great mobility. So you could see him like separate from the rest, from his weapons. Obviously, you see there. I mean, you have to wait, and 4 or 5 years later, you can use that and coach him in that direction. But you understand that at 11, 12, you already could see different ways to attack. Now you see a kid that doesn't move very well, and he plays very far back. He makes a lot of balls, but he plays far back. He doesn't move well. His foot position doesn't understand the time. So now that kid is very, it's going to be very tough to produce or develop a weapon on that kid.
Gotcha. Yeah, I love that answer. I think there's a lot in there, because it's not just, you know, the eyeball test where you can see a big serve or a big forehand. You're right. It's the power placement, time and court position are all weapons, and kids that recognize that at an early age are ahead of the game. So that's something to definitely work on.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's important for the coaches and parents and kids to understand, because I put the parents there, because you have a kid that understands the time and he understands how to close point at the net at 12 years old, but obviously they're too small to cover the court, so they lose in matches. But you see that kid, the willingness and their understanding of the court, and you have to encourage that kid to keep working on his game, because 3 years, 4 years from that point, at 16, 17 years old, when he's going to grow into his body, he's going to start like covering the court, and now he's becoming a very good athlete. So
that's the most difficult thing, I think, for a coach or a parent of a player, is to have a kid that's like that, but then they get burned by, you know, passing shots or lobs, or missed overheads, or like Robert, we always say that the classic 12-year-old point is, you know, it's played beautifully, they get the easy volley, and they miss the volley. And so then they're more reluctant not to come to the net anymore. And the other kids, you know, fist pumping because, you know, he thought he did a good job by the other kid making a volley. And, you know, it just, it's difficult, but it's one of those things that you got to.
The best 12 and under point is when there's a kid at the fence and another kid at the net, and the kid at the net gets an overhead, and the kid at the net in 12 and under hits that overhead right into the net. Right. And then the kid at the net's like putting his head in his hand, and the kid at the fence is going, "Let's go." And you're like, "What are you doing, man? You should have lost the point." Right.
No, totally. I watch, I give you an example. Tsitsipas was 16 years old, we were to Wimbledon with the kids, and Tsitsipas lost against, I don't remember, in Roehampton, junior tournament. He was playing big. I mean, it wasn't this Tsitsipas top 10. It was a kid that was good. It was coming in and serve and volley and return and play good points and coming to the net, and he ended up losing like you described. The other kid was like yelling, and I went to him after the match. I went to him and said, "Look, great match. Keep doing it. You are on the right path. Keep working." Because I like every kid. And you go to Kalamazoo, and exactly as you described, went to Kalamazoo 1,000 times. And when you see a kid like that, you have to go there, winning or losing, and encourage that part. I say, "Keep doing it. Don't worry." "Yeah, but I lost." I mean, the kid is sometimes crying. Say, "Don't worry about it. Just don't worry about it. Believe me. In 4 or 5 years, you're gonna be fine. You're gonna be fine. You're gonna understand. You're gonna have weapons. You're gonna have things to hurt your opponent. You don't want to stay 6 feet, 7 feet behind the baseline and just pushing and making balls. That's one part. Right. You could do that as a good competitor. You could do that, but you don't want to be like that the whole match. So so I try to encourage that and. As a team, we always were very detail oriented on that. I mean, having the kids like doing the right playing if you want to call like that, playing the right way, you know, the good tennis. I have my vision of how what the good tennis is, and that's the way that I see the players play, even if they're 11, 12, 13, or 25.
All right, so let me follow up. So I asked originally a player who maybe wasn't as talented, but worked really hard. So can you think of any players you coached that were the opposite? They were super talented and lazy, and no one knows who they are anymore. And you don't have to say their name. But did you coach any players who were like, man, if you would work hard, you'd be top 20, and they were lazy?
Yeah, yes. But I stopped working with those players immediately. I have my vision of on my years at the UCA, even now, I like the high performance. I like the elite. My eyes or my, that's what I enjoy the most, producing players to, or bring, try to help the players to achieve their dreams. And when I see that, it's either they change or I stop. So there's no following up with that. I mean, that's one of the non-negotiable for me. I like the talent. I like to have a player with talent. Obviously, you have an advantage if you have a player with talent. But I think talent without hard, really hard work is nothing. So that's the answer is I have several players like that, I stopped working with them.
Yeah. Diego, can you talk a little bit about the schedule that you guys use there at the USTA? Maybe for 12-year-olds versus 15, 16-year-olds. What kind of daily, on court, off court, year round kind of calendar or kind of a daily schedule were they doing in terms of time on the court and time in conditioning and time doing mental? Just break down sort of those daily routines.
Yeah. So I have to separate kind of that in three different groups.
Good.
The kids that are really young, 12, 13, 14, 15, they go through a puberty. The mm-hmm. kids, the young pro, they transition in 18 to 23, 24, 25, and then the established pro. So I usually like to do that because there's a huge difference. The kids that are going through a puberty, to produce a champion, you have to find, and that's where the coaching is very important, because you cannot under train, but you cannot either overtrain. So you have to find mm-hmm. the limit, where the limit is, and be just below that limit. This is in my experience, my opinion, and it's very difficult. Very, very difficult. The kids are growing. You have to understand. You have to weigh them, measure them almost every week. Understand where they are, when they're growing, how they're growing, what happened with the back. I mean, what happened with the elbow? How explosive are they? You have to understand every single situation. If the biomechanic is working good, if the technical aspect is very sound, everything has to be on point at that age, because if it's not, everything could fall apart. So that's huge.
Let me interrupt really quick. When you have a group of 15, 20 kids, that's almost an individual answer. How do you deal with one kid versus another, or is it sort of, hey, this group of kids is their limit, let's put them together. Another group of kids has a limit that's closer to this. Do they train together? How would you deal with that for a group?
Awesome question, Scott. Awesome question.
Yeah, my age, my date, they were 16 hours. 16 hours. Yeah. I mean, you have to individualize every kid. You have to go and you can ask the kids. I mean, I try to it's not only individualized in terms of the body, but in terms of their mind, how you talk to them, how you talk to every one of them. Example, you're not talking the same, you're not using the same words, you're not using the same tone if you're talking with Dennis Kudla or Riley Opelka or Tommy Paul or Taylor Fritz or Francis Tiafoe or William Blomberg, or you have to individualize each of them and talk to them completely separate. Now, that's one. Two, I'm a big believer on individual work. So they have a group where they play matches together, they mix it up, they do the two-on-ones, they do the rest, and almost every day they have the individual work with me, whatever it is, 40 minutes or 1 hour and a half, or whatever they need. So each of those players, they have individual work with me. So that's one. Second, every player has an individual work. Obviously, you have when they go to fitness, you have a general stuff they all do, but you understand what they need to do more for regarding injury prevention, regarding style, game style. So you like going through that with the strength conditioning with the team, and they know what they do. The technical stuff, like I say, for example, at one point when we went through those changes with Tommy Paul, he was 14 years old. He couldn't crack an egg with the forehand, and we wanted to kind of help him to develop those weapons. I was traveling with Tony Scula and with the other kids, so Ryan Harrison. So what I did was having Andy Brandy helping me. So we designed a program. So we went on in front of the TV all together with five coaches, like trying to be all agreed, because we had that protocol of no changing any shot if three or more coaches they were not agree on that change. So we were like, at that time we were like four or five coaches: Jay Berger, Andy Brandy, myself. Was also David Ramos, who was the expert on the video, and making sure that everything that I wanted to go through on the forehand and the shoulder was correct. And Andy Brandy was helping me every day, having individual work with him, for example. Same with Riley when I was traveling, and he was like 13 years old. Some of the volley workout, you know, having Tom Gullickson helping me and working on his volley when I was traveling sometimes, you know. So they had the same program for him to work on his volleys, and like this with every player. Same thing with Dennis Kudla. When I started with him, he didn't have a good serve or good forehand. He couldn't hit a forehand. And so working on him specific, that's on the technical part, but outside the tennis court, same thing. I mean, you have completely different personalities that you have to manage. So for example, Dennis Kudla is completely different personality than Tommy Paul. And you have to manage, and you have to understand that the body, same thing. So going to the limit. So you're as a coach, your journey, it becomes like your day becomes like 16 hours. If you don't want to do it, that's fine, but you're not going to develop any player. That's how it is. So that's same thing. And then you go to the next age, which is 18 to 23, 25, which right now they went through puberty. Now they're okay. Now their body, they grow into their body, they're fine. Now you can put more load. They can accept, the body will accept more load. You have to go more through the identity. So that's kind of the easy age to work. You can work hard. You can same thing. You cannot work more than two or three players, because if you work with the individual, you have them on the individual process, right? Even if you share, you have some practices that they're working together and some practices individual, and obviously same thing. They go first the difference with the fitness, sorry, I go back a little bit. The fitness, talking with the young kids in the morning, they go through more, they're understanding and they're learning their warm up. They personalize their warm up. So that's kind of in the morning, what I call the fitness in the morning. It's more about that, personalize the warm up, understanding that you always can do some routine where you can stabilize your shoulder, your core, you can do the injury prevention. So that kind of thing. And then in the afternoon, you do all the stuff that you need to do to progress and work a little bit harder. With the other kids, 18, 25, now they start, they're more established on their routine in the morning. So they go through a fitness and kind of they do a part where sometimes it's the plyometrics or some lifting in the morning. Some players, they like to do the lifting because they feel better. Even if that jeopardizes a little bit the feeling of the ball, but they feel that they can transfer that into tennis and they like that. And then same thing in the afternoon, obviously finishing the day with a harder workout. And then you have the established pro over 25, 26, with they playing a lot of matches. So now the focus is more on the recovery. Now they've been through kind of 8 or 9 or 10 preseason already where their body is strong. They don't need that much. So now it's becoming a complement of the tennis. So it's a different stage in their life. You focus on the recovery. You focus more on a specific work that they need. You understand their bodies and you understand what they still need some workout, the injury prevention, and the rest is a complement on the tennis journey.
Yeah. Hey, just real quick, just to recap a little bit. Are you saying like for the 12 to 13, 14 year olds, you'd have like a morning session where it'd be about, maintenance and injury prevention? Would there be ball hitting at that time, or would that all be in the afternoon?
Yeah. No, with, for example, with different groups, most of the groups, the kids understanding that when they're kids, they have a ton of things to learn and to explore. So they need time on court. 2 hours is not enough. For a kid that wants to be good, 2 hours is not enough. But more than 2 hours, it's difficult to have the kid focus with the mind completely engaged on the practice. So over 1 hour 30 is very tough to have the kid like completely engaged. So that's why with many kids, you need to double up the day. So you need to split the sessions and do 1.5 hours in the morning and 45 minutes in the afternoon, or 1 hour and 1 hour, or 1.5 hours and 1 hour, depending the kids and depending how good. It's not going to be both sessions are going to be physical, but for example, you can split the physical session in the morning and then the serve and return in the afternoon, or the technical work in the morning and then the physical work in the afternoon, or physical work in the morning and match play in the afternoon, things like that, where you have the kids completely engaged and willing to play.
Yeah.
Hey, so Diego, first off, let me say this. You are bringing it tonight. I mean, you got it going on. You anybody listening right now, they should be like listening with a notepad taking notes. You're bringing it. So
thank you so much. But it's the way that I live the tennis. I love to talk tennis. I love to kind of try to help and share the information and as much as I can. And it's a pleasure for me to talk about tennis. I have a lot of passion here.
I can tell. The passion. I can feel it coming out of my phone right now. So this is good stuff. So my question for you is, so. And this is a more of a personal question. So my child is, and I see this a lot with a lot of high performance kids, but he is highly competitive, but that highly competitiveness becomes emotional, and the emotions on the court prevent him from being as effective as he could possibly be. Right. Yeah. So how did you deal with those players that were so competitive that it turned into a weakness because they were emotional as a result of being competitive?
It's a great question. Obviously, you have to know the kid. My first answer to that, and the first thing that I will explore with a kid like that is using that competitiveness or put it on the right way. Try to help him to understand that. So you're so competitive. Okay. So how you can be as competitive as you are, but now focusing on the right stuff. Okay, so every practice, I'm gonna try to focus on the short-term goals. So for example, let's say that I'm working on him cutting the angle on the forehand. Okay, so I'm gonna challenge him and I'm gonna compete with him, not me, but for example, I'm gonna put a target and I'm gonna draw a line on the court. I say, okay, if you hit that target 8 times, in cutting that angle like that, you win something, and then you get you put that competitive experience on the right spot and not on winning. The outcome of the match cannot be the objective of those kids. They have that should be a product of a daily work. So I don't know the kid, and I have to understand, but there's few technique to use for the kid to understand that before to be competitive and focus only on the outcome of the matches in Kalamazoo or the Clay Court Nationals or there's something before that they can use as a
right
competitive.
So my follow-up to that is, you said when you were working with different players, you can't talk to them all the same. If I'm talking to Dennis Kudla or if I'm talking to Steve Johnson, explain what you mean by that, because I think I know what you mean, but I think you need to explain further what you mean by that.
Well, so the tone that you use, the vocabulary that you use. So some kids, they lack a more like friend-to-friend vocabulary. So now you have to, as a coach, you have to adapt to that vocabulary and talk more like, for example, kids that I have said, yes, coach, no, coach. I say, no. You, it's okay. I'm Diego. You don't tell me, coach. So because I knew that the kid, it was like he needed more like a free spirit to go to a practice. So I said,
right.
No, coach. You're not saying coach or not saying, you know. So I want you. Some kids, I let them. They threw the racket and say, it's okay. It's okay, throw the racket, because I know that that's going to bring them more blood. And I'd rather, as you teach character, which all agree that character is huge, is important, but to get there, they're going to have time and you're going to have good talk. But first, the kid needs to have fun on the court. If you like putting on the kid on the box when they play, every kid, so it's very tough for a 12, 13, 14 years old to behave perfect. You're going to get there. So what I'm saying is some kids, they need a tone, a more quiet tone. For example, talking like that, not being, yeah, I'm going to change. So you're going to be, you're going to explain for example, I give an example, and I don't mind to give you a name, William Blomberg. William Blomberg was always, since he was young, 12, 13, 14 years old, he was somebody that needed to be, every drill, you have to explain to him, right? You have to explain to him every drill, why, and what it's going to bring, and why you're gonna do that, and what is the objective of the dream? He liked that. He was like that. Tommy Paul, he didn't care. He didn't care at all. he didn't care. Francis was like, okay, we play match. No, so yeah. So you have a kid that he wants to play points, and everything that you're gonna tell him, he doesn't care, but only he will care if you put points on that. Tommy, didn't care. He didn't care about winning or losing on practice. He didn't care about the dream. He believed in me. He trusted me. And I said, whatever you say, I do it. I don't care. You know, but you have to give him the freedom. For me, you have to give him that freedom. Riley, the practice was like, okay, he has to feel the power. At some point of the practice, whatever you do, at some point of the practice, he needed to feel that he was reading the ball, he was winning points, he was like dominant on the court. You understand? So, yeah. You at the minute that you stop with one of the kids, the other kid is showing up. For example, I never let the kid that was for example I was practicing from 2 to 3 with one of them, 3 to 4 with the other, 4 to 5 with the other. I never let the kid warm up on the court. So I was like kicking them out. So the kid show up at the time, at their time, because I wanted to have that hour or 45 or 1 hour I have with the other person and having individualized that person. When he leaves, now the other kid comes, my mind switch, and now I talk differently. So, for example, that kid that you mentioned, that is, he is really competitive, but he gets into that frustration. I need to take that frustration off of him, so I need to understand how. I need to know him. I need to build a relationship. I need him to trust me, and that only happens if I spend time one-on-one with him and understand how he likes to talk to me, how he likes to what are the topics that he likes to talk, what are the things that what he, for example, maybe is he loves basketball. Maybe he likes American football, so I can talk to him through different analogies. I can bring Tom Brady on. For example, I will, if he's a Patriots fan, I will bring Tom Brady. I will show him videos of Edelman and not from Federer, for example. So I will show him Edelman catching that ball against whatever the Atlanta, you know, unbelievable catch. I will bring him Gronkowski. I will, you know, so things like that. If he's a Laker fan, I will talk to him regarding, like, I don't know, bringing quote of Kobe Bryant and things like that. So you have to understand the kid. You have to build a relationship. You have to try to get into their mind, feel comfortable, and build a trust. So I don't know if it makes sense.
Yeah, no, Diego, look, yeah. I'm telling you, man, I wish the call had started with this question, because you, the last 10 minutes have been some of the most enjoyable, but also interesting 10 minutes I've had in the last 2 years. You are so wise and interesting. But one of the things that you said that was so interesting, two things. I want to ask you this, and I want to follow up. So I love how you are describing how important it is to have a relationship with the player and to understand each player's different. And some of them, they got to feel like you're their friend. And some of them may want you to yell at them. And some, right, they're all different. And then you even said some of them, they might throw their racket and I just say no big deal, right? Because they're not going to be perfect. Because one of the things that it feels like in junior tennis, and Scott and I did a podcast a while back on this, was it feels like in junior tennis, they expect a 12-year-old to act like a 30-year-old Roger Federer, right? When Roger Federer was 12, he didn't act like he acts right now, right? And so I love that you say it's important that we understand the player, that we relate with the player and get to know the player. So my question, though, is why do you think so few coaches – do that or understand that? And because you said they can't be cookie cutter, right? They can't just try to make them all look the same, stamp the same. So why do you think so many coaches in America or in the world don't understand that relationship is so important?
I don't have an answer with that. It's a good question. I can tell you what I believe and how, and try to share that to all the coaches and all the parents, but I really don't know because we all know and we all agree that we want to build character, and that's okay. But to build character, you cannot, you know, like everybody treat everybody the same, and that's the way that we're gonna do. I don't believe on system. Mm-hmm. I don't.
Right.
So I really believe on individual work. I really believe on the, like I was mentioning. So I don't really have an answer why. I can tell you what I do, and thank you so much for your words. But it's very difficult. It's something that I will have to talk with, and I have thousand discussion about that. Many discussion with different coaches about no. He said, well, but this is not how. He said, well, that kid needs that. The other kid needs the other thing, you know. And everyone is different. And one thing that has to be the commonality is you have to let the kid express on the court. I mean, you cannot take the air out of the kid.
Okay, good.
That's important. The kids need to express themselves. They need to feel that when they are on court, they play tennis. They love what they do. They play the game. They have fun out there. And again, the personality is going to show up there because they're going to feel the pressure. And when you are under pressure is when the personality comes. It's easy to say somebody that has no pressure, say, hey, you're not gonna throw the racket. You're not going to say anything. You're not going to curse and everything. But when the kid is under pressure, that's when the personality is going to come. What are you going to do? So it's difficult. Obviously, you have to be limits. There's no negotiables and some limits.
Here's what I want you to do. So first I want to read a line, and then here's what my question to you is, but I want to read this first. So I think there's a lot of kids out there who are highly competitive, and I watch them at tournaments. They're super competitive and they're super talented, but because they're so invested in what they're doing, they're trying their hardest. When they lose, they kind of freak out. You see what I'm saying? And mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the coaches and the parents, they can't stand to watch them freak out. And so they kind of kill their, how do you say it? They kind of kill their, that's an advantage that they will have in the future. But the parents, yeah, because they're embarrassed, kind of kill it. And so, and the coaches do too. The coach is sitting there watching their player, and the player's banging their racket and crying and whatever else. And all the people sitting and watching are like, well, that guy's the coach. What the heck's he doing, right? And so here's what I want you to do. I want you to give some advice to the coaches when they have a player that's super competitive and super talented but struggles to manage their emotions when they're 10, 11, and 12. Give them some advice there real quick.
So the main advice is a process. I mean, you have to understand the process. You have to understand that the kid, the way to fix that is convince and make the kid understand that behavior is not going to help or is not helping his tennis.
Right, it's hurting you.
So the way that I describe all the time to the kid, okay? So I say, well, you have limits. And the kid look at me, I say, well, but I threw the racket in the practice, and you didn't say anything, and you like say, oh, that was okay, no problem, no big deal. But I threw the racket. What's the limit? The limit is that when you threw the racket and you start like whining on that moment of the match, you lost the focus.
Right.
If you threw the racket and you grab the racket, and then you play the best three games of your life, but the problem is that behavior, when you start whining, for example, the other thing that I encourage the kid, they say, okay, I hate whining. I hate the kid when they go on and on. Yeah, I cannot make a ball. I'm playing so bad.
Right.
Yeah, that's not acceptable. That's not acceptable for me. Why? Because that is never, I never saw a player whining like that and winning. So if you show me that you win and then you win the tournament and you play unbelievable, then I may change my mind. I never saw a kid whining. So what happened is yes, I saw even Roger Federer or Rafa Nadal like yelling once, relax, exteriorize what they're feeling at that moment, which is frustration or whatever it is, and or anxiety, whatever emotion you have at that moment, you exteriorize, and now you focus and really. So the kid, when you explain the kid that, and you work on that on daily basis in practice, the kid, they start understanding that. They right. don't need, sometimes they don't need you to take the, I call taking the air out of the kid. They need a space. Yeah. They need a space to learn. They need a space to explore things. They need to explore. They need a space to exteriorize. We have limits as adults. We need to put limits. Yes. I understand totally. But sometimes you have to let the kid going through those limits and explore those limits. And you as an adult say, well, this is the limit. Why? Look what happened. You show the kid what happened. Why? What that moment hurt his performance? Why is not? And then you start working with him, not for him. You're working with him. It's a team. It's a team effort. Coach, player, parents. It's a team effort to make him understand. Because I'm working, like I say, I'm working by understanding. I'm not telling the kid what to do. I'm convincing the kid, and I present the way that the kid that can understand what I'm talking, and they can disagree with me. At any time, I always open the door. I say, look, I don't want you to say, yes, coach, yes, Diego, I do it. No, challenge me. I need, if you disagree, tell me. Tell me that you disagree, why you disagree, what I need to present to you. And this is with the behavior, it's the same thing. I mean, so the kids are kids. You say it really well. Remember, I say to all the coaches and the parents, do you remember how you were when you were 12, 13, 14? Don't tell me that you were 13, because I wasn't perfect, and Roger Federer wasn't perfect, and Rafa Nadal wasn't perfect, and anybody was perfect. So you become the person that slowly and exploring things with the people and working on the things and understanding why certain behavior can help you in the future. But at 12, 13, 14, 18, even 18, you go through a moment where the hormones and everything, you need to exercise, you need to, you need to feel what you're doing. And I'm a big believer of that. With limits, but by understanding.
Yeah, and the way you said it, take the air out of the kids, it should be every coach's goal to push them, but never take the air out of the kid, right? That's I want to read this real quick, and then Scott, I want you to ask the next question. But so this is an article that I pulled up. It looks like it was last year. It says, after 10 successful years of grooming and mentoring America's finest young tennis players, USTA player development coach Diego Moyano has decided to move on. He'll begin working with Kevin Anderson of South Africa. One of the most respected coaches in the business, Moyano was practically the American junior tennis whisperer. Moyano was tasked with helping the top U.S. tennis juniors to transition to the professional game, and he delivered. And I'm going to tell you, Diego, you read that on the paper, and I think, whatever. But after listening to you talk, yeah, that you got it going on, man. I mean, I can see how you worked with players like Taylor Fritz and Francis Tiafoe and Tennis Sanger and delivered results, because all of those kids had different personalities. And what you were willing to do was say, you know what, your personality is different. I'm going to adjust to you, not require you to adjust to me.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your words. I mean, I like a very nice word, and I really appreciate. And yes, I don't believe that the players have to adapt to a coach. I believe that the coach has to prepare. That's why I always say, when you finish, and I, for young coaches, my advice is, you not become a coach after you play tennis or you hit some balls. You have to prepare yourself. You have to understand psychology. You have to understand biomechanics. You have to understand I mean, you have to go through a very good level of all those areas, technique, mobility. You have to go through those areas to be able to adapt to every single player to help, because coaching is that. It's try to help the kid or the player that is working with you to achieve their dreams. That's what coaching it is. It's not do what I tell you to do. It's helping you to achieve your dreams. And to do that, you have to be prepared. And that requires a lot of time, a lot of study, a lot of experience, individual work, and that's what I love to do, and I always believe on that. I think a player work with a player is like working with your own son or daughter. Same thing. I mean, you want to give them all the tools possible to kind of go through those moments and insert on the business and be successful. And that's what coaching kind of is. So that's the way that I approach this.
Okay. Hey, Diego, before we get to our rapid fire, I want to ask you one more question about sort of how you guys dealt with things at USTA, and that's how you guys dealt with injuries. Like I said, my son right now, he's sprained his knee, so he's been out for 5 weeks. I know that Robert's son has some shoulder problems in the past. I'm curious, what kind of things do you guys do to keep the kids involved in tennis while they weren't able to be, 100%? So with a sprained knee, you can't do certain things, but you can volley or you can do some other things. Were you guys taking that kind of approach, or was it just stay away from the courts until you get better? How did you guys deal with that?
No. You try to stay, because those moments are good moments to first fitness. Although understanding that for example, when you like hurt, reading about different things, present. Well, some kids they're gonna be willing to read more. Some kids they're not gonna like that. But for example, using the imagination, reading one. Two, right now on the quarantine, the platform, the live Instagram, which you can find some good, really good players talking about tennis, like the kids right now, they like the phone. Okay. So everybody's like, oh no, the phones are, well, maybe the phone, 1 hour per day or 1 hour and a half per day, looking at the right things are, could be important, could be beneficial. The other stuff is, having a routine where they understand that, for example, they have knee problems. All right, perfect, knee problems. What about the upper body? That if you're too young, the upper body is not gonna develop. You're not gonna build muscle, but your brain is gonna start understanding that it's gonna send that when you work with your weight and you do the own stuff. Your brain starts building that capacity of saying, okay, we're building, we're working. And you have that routine of injury prevention. You can work on the shoulder stability. You can work on your core. You can work for doesn't have to be 4 hours. Just start building habits. You cannot move. You cannot play with a knee, but you start building habits on injury prevention. For example, after you do the upper body routine, you can go and take care of your body. So you do your recovery stuff for your knee. And maybe there's some injury prevention on your shoulder, whatever. So that plus reading, plus talking with coaches or something like that, watching videos, watching you play some matches that you have, that's important. And you build in that routine. It doesn't have to be every day, but 3 days a week, you know that those days until you recover, you build in different habits. For the coach, same thing, to be able to connect with the kid while he's injured, I think is huge. I always had that vision of talking with the kid while they were injured. And Riley Opelka was somebody that he was, like I say, it's very difficult some kids when they're growing to be and work them on the limit. So, but building that relationship, that will happen because the kid is struggling right there. So that is building the relation while the kid is struggling, because every kid wants to be out there and playing and running. So when you have the shoulder, same thing. Okay, you have the shoulder, build a routine with the lower body. You can run. You can do stuff with your lower body. You can do the recovery. You build the things. You read. Present different options. Be smart and be creative on presenting the kid different options where he can be motivated and understand. I don't know. Let's play music, for example. Okay, you do your stuff, and now you don't want to read. Perfect. What about playing guitar? Do you like to play an instrument? Why? Because in the future, if he's connected with tennis is giving you when you travel, it's giving you so much free time on the tournament that you don't know what to do with that. So if you don't read, so now playing instrument, playing piano, playing guitar. So now you understand that when you're gonna have that, you can travel with the guitar and maybe spend time playing music, and that will canalize your anxiety, your nerve through the music. You know, things like that. I mean, you never know how the kid is gonna be in 5 years. What you can do is present opportunities, present different options, be creative for the kid to go through those tough moments, and understanding and keep getting better. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's good information.
Absolutely.
That's great information. So, Diego, we're going to move on to our rapid fire. These are quick questions with quick answers, okay? And
all
so
right.
tell me the something that a year ago you thought was true, but you realized in that year's time is actually not true. I probably should have given you an easier one, like what's your favorite bag of chips? But that was a hard one for a rapid fire.
No,
It doesn't even have to be tennis.
I cannot think of anything right now.
Well, it doesn't even have to be. It doesn't even have to be tennis related.
No, but that year ago wasn't. I thought it was true, and now I know that it's not true. I don't know. Probably something that I did a year ago. Because I'm very dynamic and I challenge myself all the time. So probably something that I was thinking a year ago that now I know that I did and I didn't do right. Probably a mistake that I did.
All right, Scott, ask the next one.
What's the biggest waste of time on a tennis court for practice?
The biggest waste of time? The phone. After practice, the phone. Sure. Right. After, that's 100% because I like when you finish the practice and you have your time with your coach and talking with your coach and like do a debrief of your practice and think about what things that you did well, things that you did, the things that you want to do better. And most of the kids, they only go through their phone and they stay like that on kind of brain dead for 30 minutes.
As soon as they hit the last ball, their mind is on their phone and it's not summarizing what they've worked on and
good
taking
point.
Account of that. Yeah.
Yeah, good point. All right, so the favorite thing you like to do off the court, non-tennis related, your favorite thing to do?
So I do triathlon, so I love to train for triathlons. My objective this year is to do an Ironman at the end of the year and also playing soccer.
So let me follow up on that. So what's the longest? Have you done a half Ironman?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Okay. Good. So which one did you do, the half Ironman?
The Miami Man.
Okay. So my wife, she's done a bunch of half Ironmans, and then we both did a full Ironman in Florida like 5 years ago.
Which one in Florida?
The one that's in Florida like in November every year, Ironman
okay,
Florida.
Okay. So that's the one. That's my objective for this year.
Yeah,
so
that's a good.
I'm already entered for that one.
The only thing that stinks about it is the wind, man. The wind on the bike.
It blows so hard. It was terrible.
They told me that. So I tried to prepare. We have a few friends that are they're doing an Ironman as well. And so that's if the time, because we don't know if we're going to be playing at that time.
Yeah.
Because right now, you know, I mean, the circuit is kind of in hold. But if I have the time, that will be my objective for this year. Also play soccer and, of course, spend time with my family. I spend time with my daughter, with my son, and with my wife.
Right.
Excellent. And hey, so now that you're coaching Kevin Anderson, what is the biggest difference what's the biggest difference that you see in coaching a player that's established like Kevin, having come from working with all the developing players like Riley and Tommy and Francis?
Well, I'm back on because before the UCA, I was working already with established pro as well. Robbie Ginebri was like 25 and Coria, same thing. So the routine. So you, when I mentioned during the talk, when they're young, you're building character, you're building their personalities, you try to help them understand every single area of their life, basically. So the on-court, the off-court, the routine, the warm-up, and everything. With established pro, now you only focus on the details. How it's becoming a performance objective. So how you get the best performance next week, next month, recognize the 3-4 things that they could change their game or their performance on the next 6-7 months or next year, next 2 years. So recognize those little things. They're very, very little and they're details, but they can have a huge impact. And how to adapt those things into a daily practices where you prepare the players to play the big events and beat the top guy. That's the difference. But you don't have to focus on the other stuff. The player is already motivated. The player is already professional. He knows or she knows what she has to do. So the focus is completely different.
So the next question
Sorry, Robert, just real quick. When you were with Coria, were you there in 2004 at the French Open with him?
No.
Okay.
I started with him in 2005, November 2005,
okay.
I started with him.
Okay.
All right, so this is one of my favorite questions, and we got it from another podcast, Adam Blitzer's podcast. And so the question is, what's something that you believe to be true and everyone you're around thinks is crazy?
Same thing. I don't know. I need to think about those questions. I need to have my own thought about
We should have sent him ahead of time.
Probably it's not a thinking but my energy. Everybody mentioned that my energy and my the way that I'm just jump on bed early morning and then I have like it looks like I'm a 220 volt all day long, and everybody thinks that I'm crazy. I'm finishing the practice. I can practice for 10 hours and then go and run 10K and go bike and keep going. That's kind of that. It's not a thought, but it's a way to live. Kind of. I live my daily routines are like all in all the time.
I love it,
and I can attest to that. A few years ago at the Knoxville Challenger, I saw you practicing and warming up with Tommy and I think Riley, and I thought you were one of the players. You look fantastic.
Yeah. I mean that's the way, and same thing. I mean, and again, we go to a hotel, we take a shower, and then boom, go to dinner, and like in dinner we talk, we go through different topics and share things and share the stories. So it's never end. It go. I wake up at 6 and I go to bed at 11 for someone, and in the middle it's like all in. I full go.
That's I love
it. Everybody's telling me that's crazy. So that's the only thing that I can think.
I love it.
Well, hey, that's a good place to end, Diego. We appreciate your time. I know we went a little bit long, but that's your fault because you kept us kept us interested, and we wanted to learn more. So I appreciate the time. Hopefully, we can do it again, and hopefully we'll see you somewhere around the country this year if tennis gets back on track.
Yeah, stay in touch, Diego. Thank you. Stay in touch. You're awesome, man. This was awesome. This is so much fun.
Thank you so much for your work. Thank you so much for having me. I really love to talk tennis and try to share everything. And again, I'm very open whenever you guys think that can be a positive thing. I mean, I'm always open to talk with you guys. And thank you so much for having me again. And hope, like you said, hope I see you guys soon on the tour.
I'm sorry. Before we do sign off, I know that you're doing a lot of Instagram lives. What's your Instagram handle where they can watch some of your content?
That's right. That's a good question.
Diego A. Moyano. So in Instagram, I have my I start my new project as well. Diego Moyano High Performance Tennis, where I upload all the interviews as well on my webpage. On my website and YouTube as well. So I try to share as much as I can. So if you're interested, there are a ton of really good interviews with coaches in English and Spanish. And so biomechanics, psychology, strength conditioning coaches. I try to go through different areas where the people can take advantage of that.
Yeah, and your interview with Mark Kovacs was fantastic, so I highly recommend that one.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, I learned how to record the interviews right after I interview Paul Anacom and Brad Gilbert, but those two, they were really good, and I didn't know how to record it. I learned that the day after that, so I'm like, oh, Jesus, I cannot do that. Well. Now everything is on my account, and I try to upload the post, and everybody can watch it.
Excellent.
Well, it was so much fun. Appreciate you being on.
All right.
Bye, guys. Thank you so much. Have a good night.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.